Hello, everyone. We had a bit of a problem, and the last class was not recorded, so I'm going to record it now. Those of you who get it sent to you and listen to it afterwards, it won't be the same class, obviously, because I'm not. There's not going to be the give and take with the other participants, which is so much of a part of the typical class. So I'm not really sure how long it will go. I will try, if I recall the questions that were asked, I will mention them. Well, let us begin. This is the third class on the Chacham Sofer. It's the last class of the semester, after which we'll have, of course, the Pesach break. And after Pesach, I hope to return for, I think there'll probably be four more classes. Before we start, just a couple things I want to point out. I had mentioned, I do want to stress, you know, we've been speaking a lot about Rabbi Nosson Adler. And you know, some of his perhaps unusual minhagim reviewed as unusual. We do need to stress that we're talking about someone who was one of the great sages of his era. To be sure that the people, the other great rabbis who put him in Cherem, were of mixed feelings doing so, and imagine them even crying as they signed the Cherem document. We're not dealing with a Hasidic Rebbe who maybe Talmudists didn't have respect for him. Nosson Adler was a universal tzaddik and Talmud Chacham, Halacha's authority. But it was felt, as we spoke about, that it was a danger. And when we return after Pesach, I'll deal with more what was viewed as dangerous. I also want to clarify a couple more things. We were speaking about the Familians Law last class, which because I said they were introduced by Maria Theresa, that you couldn't marry unless you were the oldest son, and it had to be after your father died. Actually, it wasn't Maria Theresa. I made a mistake. I misspoke. Although she's often identified with it, because although her father, Charles VI, in 1726, is the one who institutes it, Maria Theresa becomes empress in 1740, and she rules for 40 years, so she's often identified with the. One more thing about Rav Nosson Adler, and speaking about unusual practices, I spoke about that how during Tachanun, he would do complete prostration, and the Chasam Sofer also did that. I don't think I was clear that this is described in the sources as Pishut Yadayim V'Raglayim, which means actual laying down completely on the ground. Luckily problematic, perhaps, although if you look in the Mishnah Berurah, he mentions that some people think that this is acceptable. Others hold that we can never do that today. And finally, I quoted the famous passage of Yisrael Salanter that anyone who allows himself to be booted out is not a man. And I translated it as not a mensch. I don't know if that's the correct translation, actually. The Hebrew versions that I've seen refer to not an Adam. It could be the way I translated it means not a mensch. That is, you didn't behave properly as a rabbi. You got so many people upset. So if you were more of a mensch, you wouldn't have been booted out. It could, though, be the word Adam is used in the sense that we use man. Like, if you allowed yourself to be booted out, then you're not a man. Okay, let us, these are all points that with the class, we went into discussion in detail. But not having a class here, we'll just move on. I ended last class by saying that, unlike what appears in various hagiographies, the Chacham Sofer's time in Pressburg was not the easiest time, and he had opposition. We even have a letter from some members of the community to the Chacham Sofer before his arrival. They tell him that they are involved with government officials and in business with non-Jews, and thus they have to wear non-Jewish clothes and to cut their hair and shave, even during Svira and Chol HaMoed. They also tell the Chacham Sofer that their daughters' wives wear makeup and wigs. Quote, they go here and there, some to pass the time, some to support the members of their families. And although these customs and matters may not appear to be quite proper in the eyes of our teacher and rabbi, that's referring to the Chacham Sofer, nevertheless, in a big city like this, things cannot be changed. They add that according to the local custom, the Rav of the city has no authority to supervise the normal activities of the members. His only task was to, quote, spread Torah, instruct people in the way of the Lord by means of ethical instruction, and to issue legal rulings on matters of religious practice. And I think that most rabbis coming to a city recognize that they can't overstep their bounds. The problem is that no matter what the rabbi does, he's going to assume that, at least I think he's going to assume, that he's spreading Torah. And this is part of his role. However, the people who wrote this letter to the Chasam Sofer, people who are willing to support the Chasam Sofer as rabbi, unlike some on the more liberal side talk about who were very opposed from the beginning to the Chasam Sofer, these people were willing to accept the Chasam Sofer. All they wanted was that he overlook those things he might not agree with. Which, as I mentioned, any good rabbi knows that you don't speak out on everything. These people, we know, were afraid that the conservative segments of the community, the conservative segment, and they were, and there was this battle between the more liberal and the conservative segment. When I say the conservative segment, I'm not speaking about reformers or anything like that, but people more open-minded, maybe more of a German Orthodox type mentality. They were afraid that the conservative segment of the community would use the Chasam Sofer to attack them, attack their lifestyle. So they sent this warning to the Chasam Sofer before he assumed his post, telling him that, yes, you know, you're coming to town, but stick to matters that concern you. Don't put your nose into the way our wives are dressing. You know, the Chasam Sofer was very opposed to the wearing of shadels. This is mentioned in his ethical will. But apparently they knew already that the Chasam Sofer did not look kindly upon this. Now, this early, in addition to this one I just mentioned, there was other opposition to the Chasam Sofer, but it's not reported by his grandsons, who were his early biographers. His grandson, who was assisted by other grandchildren, in the Bukhut HaMashuash. If you look in Greenwald, Kusil Yehuda Greenwald, who well known in America because he's the author of the Kobo Ha'avelos. This is the Sefer which, until really the 1980s, I think every American rabbi needed to have it. And they probably still do have it. It was the only book on Avelos, mourning. It has all sorts of questions, deals with every possible case you can imagine. And he was a rabbi in Columbus, Ohio. In addition to being a halachic authority, he wrote a number of works of halacha. He's best known as being a Jewish historian, and particularly a historian of orthodoxy. He wrote a great deal on all aspects. He wrote on the Shulchan Aruch, on Jonas and Eibschitz, but mostly on Hungary, and orthodoxy in Hungary, also in Germany, some times. And one of his books is called Matzevas Kodesh. You can find it on HebrewBooks.org. It devotes itself to the study, first of all, of not just the city of Siget, but also of Matersdorf and the Seven Kilot. As with all of Greenwald's writings, full of great information. But on page 138 and 139, you'll see that he's very upset that the biographers, in particular the grandson he's speaking about, omits any mention of the arguments that the Chasam Sofer was involved with when he came to town. And Greenwald doesn't see this as an honest way to write history. He goes further. He says that every great Torah sage has had to deal with problems when they in various cities. Especially since they were trying to uphold tradition. And it is, does not take away from the greatness of a sage to record this. If you read Greenwald, you read others, you read about some of the disputes. In fact, the community leaders got so upset with the Chasam Sofer once that they forbid him to preach. They banned him from giving drashos, except for haspedim, eulogies. Now, according to Rabbi Akiva Joseph Schlesinger, the reason, who was not from the next generation, the reason was because the Chasam Sofer used one of his hasbedim to attack the communal leaders. Actually, the Yosef Schlesinger is probably really two generations later. So he used one of his hasbedim while he was while he was under the ban. He used to preach. He used one of his hasbedim, which was the only thing they let him do, to attack the communal leaders. So, but why do they prevent him speaking? I mentioned that sometimes great rabbis get in the class that wasn't recorded. I mentioned that the case of Rabbi Soloveitchik is another example of a great rabbi who the leaders refused to allow him to speak during the Great Dispute in the 1970s about changing the charter of Yeshiva University to a secular university. The Rav was very opposed to this. And at one event with Dr. Belkin, the Rav starts speaking and protesting this change, and he expresses his identification with the students who are protesting this. They used to consult with him on how to stop this. It turned out the Rav was completely wrong, that the charter was changed, and it didn't affect YU as an institution at all, at least the undergraduate. But you can hear on the tape, as the Rav's speaking, Dr. Belkin gets up, you know, he stops him, he actually takes the microphone away from him. And there was this big feud between Belkin and the Rav. There wasn't eventually, you know, Belkin would then pass away. Later was 5 or 6 years, maybe a little, I'm not sure exactly the year when they had this event where Dr. Belkin took the microphone away from the Rav. But it's been said that had the Rav's wife, Tanya Soloveitchik, been alive, they wouldn't have had this break because she was very fond of Dr. Belkin. In any event, what was it that the community leaders were so upset with that they banned the Chassam Sofer from speaking? We're told that in one of his drashos, the Chassam Sofer said that Rishayim, evil people, get no reward for the mitzvos being Adam Achaveiro, that is, the mitzvos between man and his fellow man, that they perform, because they don't intend to fulfill God's will in their actions. They only are doing it because they think it's a good thing to do. This is an old dispute. Does one need to have the proper intention or have a recognition of the revelation of the mitzvot in order to be said to fulfill them with any sort of get any sort of schar, any sort of reward? You can see in Hilchos Malachim of the Rambam, he says, according to one version, that non-Jews who fulfill the Shev Mitzvot B'nei Noach and don't recognize that these are due to a revelation from to Moses at Sinai, that is, they just happen to be good people, that this doesn't count in terms of them getting a share in the world to come. But yet, there's another version which says that while these people are not regarded as Chassidei Umot Olam, they're nevertheless regarded as wise people, Chachmei Umot Olam, and Rav Kook thought that wise people are actually on a higher level than Chassidei Umot Olam. But the Chassam Sofer's position is that there is no reward, no heavenly reward, and no recognition of the greatness of an act, therefore, if it doesn't come along with recognition of its heavenly origin. The leaders, scholar-oriented leaders in Pressburg, used this speech, this drasha that the Chassam Sofer gave, to attack him, saying that he was against universal moral values. Because what could be more against universal moral values than saying that good people, people who are doing the good because it's good, that they will receive no heavenly reward? That was the Chassam Sofer's position. There were other examples of opposition, but I think it's hard for me to imagine that even Yosef Schlesinger, who was very much an extremist, wrote the Lev Ivri. I don't know if I can believe the following I'm going to tell you, because no other source does it appear, and there's a lot of sources that deal with the opposition of Chassam Sofer. As I said, it's not in the biography of his grandson or in hagiographies, but other sources. Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger claims that there were real reformers in Pressburg who, on Tisha B'Av, ate in public opposite the Chassam Sofer's house. Could this be true? Did you have such people in Pressburg? None of the sources that speak of Pressburg even talk about the public Sabbath violators. And here to imagine that there are people who would set up a table across from the Chassam Sofer's house and start eating on Tisha B'Av, I do not believe this. As I said, there is no evidence that there were any public violators. Of course, there are people who are not really observant. Please have that, but not in a public way. Yet, as I said, there is opposition. In fact, we know from more than one source that the communal leaders, although originally they agreed to have a yeshiva there, many of them soured on it, and they wanted to get rid of the yeshiva. The most powerful communal leader goes to the government and complains about the 200 students at the yeshiva. This is in the mid-1820s. In later years, before the Chassam Sofer dies, the yeshiva population would go up to 300. even reached 400. But they complained about the students in the yeshiva, that they, and he complained, and he was backed by other communal leaders, that these students were being taught ignorance and superstition, and they wanted the school shut down. Chassam Sofer was able, however, to prevent the school from being shut. He had to submit, however, written answers to the government in German, explaining what the yeshiva was all about, what was studied there, etc. If you look in Greenwald's, another book of his, Otzar Nechmat, also has halakha, as well as history, various historical matters, letters from the great sages. Look on page 73 and on, and you see that both the Chassam Sofer's letter and the letter from the community leaders. You can see the community leaders don't like the Chassam Sofer at all. They accuse him of liar. They say that he's misleading people. These are not the only communal leaders. There were figures who Chassam Sofer side, but these were machers, Haskalah-oriented machers. Well, they couldn't get the yeshiva closed down. The Chassam Sofer was able to prevent that. So they decided to open up a liberal school for the youth. That is, a school that would teach Torah and also secular studies. And but the traditional forces, led by the Chassam Sofer, were able to convince the government that this new school, which was supposed to be named after Emperor Francis II, who was the Emperor of Austria, the last Holy Roman Emperor, was a reformist institution. And I don't know if it would have been a reformist institution per se. We know that Aaron Chorin came to Pressburg. They consulted with Aaron Chorin. But this was before Aaron Chorin was really a complete reformist. It definitely was going to be a Haskalah school. But since they were able to prevent, that is, the traditionalists were able to convince the government. This is a reformist institution. The government was afraid of reform. They're always afraid of reform. The school was not permitted to open. One of the supporters of this school was a man by the name of Bear Oppenheimer. He was a Talmud Chacham, a great Talmud Chacham, but also a Maskil. He was not a great fan of the Chassam Sofer. You can see his book on HebrewBooks.org, the title is Made the Air. If you look at it, you'll see letters of different Gedolim, including two letters from the Chassam Sofer, letters from all the Gedolim in Bohemia, Moravia, from Rav Shmuel Landau. There's even one letter from the Sosa Choshen. I think there's two, maybe three letters from the Chassam Sofer. And yet if you look, as I said, in the book, you will see there's no approbation, no haskama from the Chassam. That tells you something. You publish a book in Pressburg. You're from Pressburg, and you publish a book. The book is actually printed in Vienna. But you're from Pressburg, and you don't include an approbation from the Rav of the city, from the Chassam Sofer. That shows you that there are issues here. We know that people would say about his book, his book is Mayber, and they would say, they punned on what appears. Their pun was "Mimei be'er lo nishteh." Don't drink from this book. It says in Bamidbar, "Lo nishteh mibe'er." So this is "Mimei be'er lo nishteh." Don't ignore this book. And this was a problematic book. Most people didn't use this book when they reprinted. When they printed all the Chassam Sofer's tshuvas, they collected them from various journals and works. They obviously took the tshuvot that are in here. But that's, I guess, a good use. But in terms of using the Mayve Air to use what Bear Oppenheimer himself says, that the book was avoided. Today, who knows about this? The average person knows nothing about this sefer. They're going to see it online, HebrewBooks.org or elsewhere. And one of the Gedolim, Bear Oppenheimer, Hector Oppenheimer. That is a Gedolim in this book, so he must be one of the Gedolim, and they'll use it. However, as I mentioned, he was not one of the, he was a religious Jew, of course. Maybe he would have fit in very well in Germany. But in Pressburg, because of his open-minded approach to matters, he's more of a Purim Derech Eretz philosophy, I categorize it that way. He had controversy with the Chassam Sofer. And he stood behind this new school, which they were able to get closed down. The traditional community, however, they knew that you needed this. And the Chassam Sofer himself believed in secular education to a certain extent. He hired tutors for his own children. So they opened a school that is the traditional community in which they taught Torah, and in addition to Torah, a trade. And the Chasam Sofer believed that, although he did not believe in studying philosophy and anything that could lead to heresy, he had no problem at all and saw this as a positive thing in having a school that could teach the students a trade. He believed that when you study, let's say, languages, he had his children taught languages, you don't want to be taught by a heretic, you'd rather be taught by a non-Jew. But the community, the traditionalist community, recognized the need for a school, and with the Chasam Sofer's backing and under his patronage, for his auspices, they open a school. For a school that today in the land of Israel, they will not permit to be open, because they'll say that Torah only is the approach. As we already saw, the very first class, the Chasam Sofer, that Torah only in the land of Israel is not the proper approach. In the Chutz La'aretz, Torah only is an acceptable approach, but the average person can't just say Torah all day, so you need schools to train them so they can make a living. For all the Chasam Sofer's greatness, he was not perfect. And there was a time when he publicly confessed his error. What happened was that he gave an approbation without investigating the matter properly. And he confessed his error. And whereas other rabbis might have covered up their mistake, been embarrassed, the Chasam Sofer is open about his mistake. And this then becomes historic because people look upon the Chasam Sofer as one who's, the comedic expression is, there you see his greatness, you see his humility. What was the issue? He gave an approbation for a canon translation. And then, as I said, he will retract it. His retraction becomes important in all the polemics against art. There's people who carry on polemics against the art scroll translation, and they always cite the Chasam Sofer. But let's, before we get into the details, and most of the details will be next semester, because this issue that the hour ended last class that wasn't taped. There was a man named Ephraim Pinner, who was fine Jew. The Chasam Sofer tells us that he was a fine Jew. He came to Pressburg, he spent time there, and the Chasam Sofer saw no problems with him or his behavior. And he had a plan to translate the Talmud into German. He told the Chasam Sofer that he had that certain great rabbis had already signed on to it. One of them was Rabbi Nassim Adler, related to, but not the same Nassim Adler we've been speaking about. The Nassim Adler I'm speaking of right now was the rabbi in Hanover, Germany. He then goes to England, where he beats out Samson Raphael Hirsch to become chief rabbi of England, succeeded by his son Hermann Adler. But he's known in the Jewish world as the Netina Lager, Nesina Lager, because he wrote a commentary on Targum Onkelos to the Torah. So a big Talmud Chacham, and I believe, in fact, he is the first rabbi to receive a doctorate before any of the famous ones in Germany. Received it at Erlangen University. So he was supposed to be involved. What was the reason for this translation? Pinner wanted to show the non-Jewish world that the Talmud wasn't anything to be afraid of, that it was a great work. Rabbi Solzhenitsyn had a similar plan, except he wasn't focused on the non-Jews like Pinner was. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's focus, he wanted Talmud to be taught in the universities because he wanted people to see that this is a serious work. You often have people who look at Talmud when they leave, let's say, traditional Judaism, they don't see it as something serious. They see it as something they want to get far away from. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter thought that if Talmud study, a chair, let's say, a Talmud study in a top university, they were taking Talmud study seriously. Like they do today in Korea. We had a discussion about what's going on in Korea. This then would show Jews who were on the verge of rejecting Judaism, even had rejected it and wanted nothing to do with traditional Jewish learning, that this would show them that Talmud is really very serious. If the non-Jewish professors view it as something important and serious, then obviously Jews the same way. So Rabbi Yisrael Salanter wanted to raise the prestige of Talmud assimilated Jewish world's eyes. That's why he supported it. We've gone pretty quickly here. I don't know if I've even been speaking about 20, 25 minutes. But this is really all we covered in the class that mistakenly was not taped. I responded to many questions. We got into a big discussion about Talmud translation and other things. I'm not going to repeat those here. First of all, I can't remember all the details. And second of all, you need to have the give and take. So let me just end by saying again, it's been a wonderful semester. I thank all of you who made me work this semester, sent me all the questions. I've mentioned some of you by name, others I haven't mentioned by name in previous classes, but I thank you all. It's been a great semester, and I look forward to picking up with you again after Pesach. Thank you very much.